Offering a most humble pranam at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai, welcoming you to yet another episode of Shravanam Mananam Nididhyasanam. And as always, I'm being joined by Brother Sai Prakash. And like we had the pleasure last week, we have this week too the company of Professor Venkatraman. And if you were with us last week, you would know that we were going through a comprehensive summary. We have finished 8 discourses in the 1990 summer course series. We are exactly midway, and we completed a summary of the first 3 discourses, and we are going to begin the summary of the 4th discourse, and we pray to Bhagwan to help us do this, because as you will listen, you will understand that this is not an easy task. Swami has said so many things, and each one is as profound as the other, and nothing can be left out. We just pray to Swami that we are successful in this endeavor. So, to start the program, I welcome Professor Venkatraman and Brother Sai Prakash. Salam to both of you.
Salam. And as you were just mentioning, this is definitely one step more difficult, right, and one step subtler than the body. In the last discussion, we discussed the various aspects of the human body. But now we are going on to the senses and the mind. So, already we are going one step into the subtler realms. You know, Swami starts off very beautifully with a very elaborate poem. I think I should just read it out. So it gives a very good context to the entire discourse. Yes. On the senses. He says, "One may acquire great scholarship and come out victorious in assemblies of scholars. One may be a great hero and win battles galore. One may generously give away in charity gold and cows. One may be able to count the countless stars that adorn the sky. One may be able to name the innumerable species of living beings. One may be well versed in Ashtanga Yoga. One may be successful in reaching the moon, but no one can control their body and senses, nor conquer their mind and keep it in a state of constant introversion and unshakable equanimity." That's more or less like a challenge that Swami is throwing open to everybody. And one thing which really comes out from this poem is knowledge of the world and scholarship in the world is an achievement in sort, but it has nothing to do with this inner world or in your spiritual inquiry and your spiritual progress.
Right. And in fact, Swami is making the last statement. Swami is saying to keep it in a state of constant introversion.
Mm-hmm.
You might be able to do it once in a while, or some kind of control is possible.
Correct.
To keep it in that state of constant introversion and unshakable equanimity. That's the real challenge.
That's the real challenge. And Swami, of course, brings out the point that senses are subtler than the body. And he says that the senses definitely wield a great deal of influence on the body.
Right. And then like Swami did on the discourse on the body, where Swami gave different definitions for the body, Swami does the same here with the senses too. Swami starts by calling the senses matraha.
True.
He says that is a name. And one meaning of this word matraha means a measuring instrument.
That's true.
That which gives you an ability to measure your environment around.
Correct.
And Swami speaks about the tongue, where the mm-hmm. tongue gives you the ability to see whether the food is palatable or not.
True.
So it is, in a sort, all the senses are a measuring instrument, a matra.
And the other meaning of matra, he says, is a limit.
Right.
A matra, this much alone. So it's kind of a limit. So senses also have to be used within limits.
Right.
Then he goes back to that very famous analogy that's given in the Kathopanishad, where he says the senses are equated to the horses of the chariot.
Right. And from there, Swami draws this beautiful explanation of what is the Ashwamedha Yajna, which is very often referred to in most of the ancient scriptures.
Mm-hmm.
And Swami says Ashwa is a horse. Mm-hmm. And as Swami mentioned before, horse is equated to the senses.
Correct.
And Medha is intellect.
Correct.
And Swami says, why is senses and a horse equated? Because the nature of a horse is to be constantly wavering, constantly moving.
Mm-hmm.
And Swami also says that's why the peepal tree is called the Ashwata tree.
Correct.
Because the leaves are constantly wavering.
True.
And Swami says Ashwamedha means the fickle-minded intellect.
Mm-hmm.
And to do a sacrifice of the fickle-minded intellect
mm-hmm.
is what is Ashwamedha Yajna.
Very good.
And Swami says that a person who does Ashwamedha Yajna in the older days would be called a Dhimanta.
Correct.
Means he is a man of great valor because he has the ability to control a horse.
Correct.
And Swami says in the spiritual field, he is a Dhimanta who is able to control his senses.
Very true. You know, when we were just discussing about this first poem that Swami was Swami had given before the, you know, he actually started the discourse. I would just like to, I was just wondering, when the knowledge that is so apparent and so prevalent in the world of today, how do scholars and scientists or even people who pursue it systematically, sincerely and honestly all through their lives? Sir, I would just like to ask you this doubt. How is it that in spite of all their knowledge, they miss something, they miss this truth, which looks very obvious now after Swami has brought it out?
Which truth are you talking about?
The truth about your true nature. I mean, when Swami actually brings it out, when we hear to the discourse, we feel, yes, this is the truth, and we feel very convinced about it. Of course, putting it in daily practice is a different issue. But the question that what we see and what we are seeing outside is actually an imagination. How is it that most of the people who have sincerely pursued knowledge have missed it?
Well, anybody can be fooled. You go in the desert because of natural phenomena, you see mirages.
Correct.
So, it's not that you are a fool, but things happen in a way, and if you don't apply your discrimination, you are getting fooled. Okay. I'll give a very simple example. You go to a movie. Things happen in the movie, but you become so identified with what is happening. You become a part of the movie, you feel happy when there are things are going nice, and you feel unhappy when terrible things are happening and all that.
Correct.
You don't sit back and say, oh, that's just a fleeting image on a white piece of cloth. You don't say that.
Right. Correct.
And yet you know, actually you are paying money to get fooled.
That's beautiful.
Sometimes you pay a lot of money.
Especially on the weekends.
On the opening day particularly. Okay. You pay so much money just to be able to say. So it just shows the power of delusion. We just don't think about these things. In fact, it is really very strange. And a very famous scientist called Freeman Dyson has talked about this openly. He says, this world is made of atoms. Of course, the atom has got subtlety. If you ignore that, the interaction between atoms is explained by a theory called quantum electrodynamics. It's a very beautiful theory because it can predict results very, very accurately. The famous physicist Richard Feynman, who was one of the discoverers of quantum electrodynamics, or founding fathers, he said it's the jewel of physics. But there were many versions of quantum electrodynamics. One was offered by Tomonaga in Japan, Schwinger in America, and Feynman in America. They all look very different. And this Dyson said they are not different. They are actually equivalent to each other. And the Feynman's version is the most useful one. So he is sort of one who categorize the Vedas, shall we say. Now, he says, if I have to explain it, I have to start with abstract quantum fields, and then I can explain everything. Mountain, tree, whatever it is. But when I see that, I don't see abstract, I see a beautiful mountain and all that. So, is that true or is this true? This is a very important question. For example, have you ever wondered, I mean, if you have seen a sunrise or a sunset, the sun is very big and it's very red. But once the sun goes up, say in the case of sunrise, it becomes smaller. What, did the sun go on a diet or something in a few minutes? Why did it look so big and red and now it's so bright? There is an explanation for it. I won't go into all that. Nevertheless, you perceive it so.
Correct.
And another example of how we are fooled. We are sitting here, we think everything is still.
Mm-hmm.
And like last time when we had an earthquake and the building actually shook.
Correct.
This time, we are sitting and everything is still. But are you aware, planet Earth is moving at a tremendous speed in its orbit around the sun? No, I am very still.
Mm.
Even a yogi who is sitting and meditating is actually moving through space at a very fast speed.
Correct.
So there is a thing called perception.
Mm-hmm.
And this perception is given to us mainly for survival purposes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. See, you have been created with life and you are supposed to live, you are supposed to protect yourself. So you have been given various input devices which are connected to the brain, and the brain is connected to the body, and depending on the inputs that you receive, the control systems work and they take action. For example, you are going on the road, you see a thorn, the signal goes from the eye to the brain and the brain says, move over, avoid mm-hmm. the thorn. So, that is necessary.
Mm.
Now, all the scientists and all that, they are describing a certain thing which they see with their eyes and experience with their senses.
Mm-hmm.
Perfectly reasonable thing to do. But, and they also know that what you see and the explanation give are different. The explanation is subtle, but what you see is very material, and so on. But there they stop.
Hmm.
Then they don't ask. They take for granted that space and time mm-hmm. exist. We exist within that, and there is no need to question it any further. But the time has come when we have to ask that question, because we now know that space-time that we experience
mm-hmm.
came into existence 13.8 billion years ago.
Right. Correct.
So what was there before that?
Mm-hmm.
That's one question. We don't know. There is speculation of all kinds, but nobody knows what is correct. And one man has even suggested how to verify whether there was a mother, and that mother had a mother, and so on. Maybe that experiment will get done and we will get some clues. But then still there is another mystery. In this universe, life is pretty rare. We think life could be elsewhere, but so far we have not been able to detect it. Because life as we exist, as we see it on planet Earth, requires very special conditions. So, how did this life come about in this planet, which was created as an inert object?
Correct.
There are questions.
Mm. Right?
So these wise people, if you ask them, they wouldn't be able to tell you. They are not wise. They are knowledgeable.
Mm.
In the olden days, people thought about these things, and they realized there must be something beyond all that we see. Something that is transcendental. Is there such a thing? They said, let us find out.
Mm-hmm.
And then they realized that in order to find out such a thing, if it existed, they must get rid of all the disturbances.
Mm-hmm.
And the disturbances are the senses and the mind. So they first learned how to control the senses and the mind. Mm-hmm. Ashwamedha. So from Medhavi, they went to Buddhiman. And through the tunnel of Buddhi, they could see something beyond.
Mm-hmm.
Veda, Meyam, Purusham, Mahantam, mm-hmm. Aditya, Varnam, Tamasap, Prastha, Swami has quoted that. There is something beyond the senses. There is something beyond the mind. Since it is beyond the mind and the senses, I cannot write it down. I cannot describe it.
Oh.
Only what the mind grasps can becomes a thought, and thought can be expressed as a word or written down or made mm-hmm. into a movie or whatever. But it is beyond the mind.
Mm-hmm.
Then how do you find that out? You have to experience it. Now, what is the sensor that can experience that thing? Is it built into us?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. A piece of that thing is inside us. That is the Atman. Divyatma Swarupanara. This Atman can resonate with the eternal because that piece is here. And that resonance, you feel.
Mm-hmm.
And you feel it as bliss.
Okay.
And it is not such a weird thing.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, we have all gone through it, but we don't know it.
Correct.
Go back to the days of darshan.
Mm-hmm.
You are sitting there, and Swami comes, stops right near you. He smiles. For a moment, you forget everything. It is only him. I remember one occasion.
Mm-hmm.
I had gone to Vrindavan for teaching. I came back. And Swami came and stood in front of me and gave an extraordinarily beautiful smile. I never got it again. And for that 1 second, I experienced bliss. I can't even describe it.
Mm.
It never happened again. But for 1 second, he just gave a glimpse of it. So can we be in that state for longer periods?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you do TM, you can do that. Be for longer periods. Can we be there eternally?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes. You have to merge with him. So that means you have to get rid of the senses. This is a junk, I'll throw it out. When that stuff comes through this. So, wise people are not, whom we call, they are not wise.
Mm-hmm.
They are knowledgeable. And sometimes, their knowledge overtakes them,
mm-hmm.
overpowers them, I should say,
mm-hmm.
and makes them mad, egoistic and dangerous.
Okay.
So, a wise man can never be dangerous, mm-hmm. because he has gone beyond knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
This knowledge is of that of the world. It's of no use to him.
Mm-hmm.
He has to throw it away in order to experience bliss. I don't know whether I've answered your question.
Yes,
very good. One point which Swami makes here, I think it comes in the next discourse of the senses, but since we're talking about it, Swami says when the senses are drawn by the mind, it becomes pravritti marga.
Mm.
But
absolutely.
When it is pulled and drawn and guided by the intellect, it becomes nivritti marga. You go inward. And very interesting because what Sir said, generally that's what happens when you are attracted to an object. You think having more of that object will give you more happiness. But it is with a guru like how Swami say, you said about Swami, you felt that Swami kindled that happiness which was inside you already. And you tend to
absolutely.
Seek within instead of seeking more of it outside.
Now getting on with the discourse, then Swami gives a very beautiful analogy. He says, if you have one wife itself, it's difficult to manage. And if you have two wives, he gives the example of Dhruva's father, Uttan's father. Then three wives, he gives the example
Dasharatha.
Of Dasharatha. Then he says, think of the mind. The mind is a VIP. It has got 10 wives.
So Jesus Christ.
Pancha Karmendriyas and Pancha Gyanendriyas. So the Pancha Gyanendriyas are sight, hearing, taste, touch and smell. And Pancha Karmendriyas are hands, legs, vocal cords, organs of excretion and reproduction. So he says, the mind, you can imagine how it's stone.
It has to please ten wives.
And very beautifully, in the course of the discourse, Swami gives 15 methods to control senses.
Right.
I mean...
No, before that, just talking about these wives, just before this, Swami makes a point.
Why are you talking about
No, because Sir, Swami makes a very good point. Swami says that understand the mind is the master.
Mm.
The problem is because you're treating the senses as the wives, the mind as the husband and the senses as the wives.
Mm-hmm.
You have to understand that the mind is the master and these are the slaves. Having that kind of a relationship with the mind and the senses will actually give you more control over yourself.
Mm.
What is that again?
Swami says you have to understand that the mind is the master and the senses are the slaves.
It's not the mind should not act according to the senses. The senses should act according to what the mind dictates.
Mind dictates.
Inspired from buddhi.
Yeah, but you must make it clear that you are not saying that mind is your master.
No, that's not that.
So the way you said it, I got that doubt.
Okay. Not that way. Right.
You have to master the mind.
You have to master the mind, yes. And then, of course, going to the 15 methods to control the senses.
I think we should quickly run through. One is, the first one is, of course, by understanding the nature of the senses, that they are the horses, and becoming dhimanta, like how we just discussed, by doing the ashwamedha yajna within ourselves. He says the limit, matra. The senses are called matra because they should be used within the limit. Yeah. Then the other meaning of matra is it is only meant for a particular purpose and you should not use it as you please. You should use it for a particular purpose.
Right. Actually, one of the examples Swami says is taking of snuff.
Yes.
The nose is meant for something, use it only for that. You know, using it for other purposes is...
He says there is a double fault there. First of all, you are not using the sense given to you properly. Second, you are ruining your health. So he says both are double, like...
Then some practical things which Swami says is keeping the senses busy and not pampering them. Not giving them what they seek, but giving them work to suit your purpose.
In fact, he connects this with the example from the Kathopanishad. He says, if you give the horses too much of importance and put them inside the chariot, how will the chariot move forward? The horses are meant to pull the chariot.
Right. And then equal-mindedness is the best way for sense control. Because Swami gives that very beautiful analogy. He says, like somebody is talking ill of you, it doesn't affect your peace of mind unless and until you hear it.
Yeah.
So though it has been spoken ill about you, it doesn't hurt you because you have not heard it.
No, it's not a question of not hear it. Because you don't become deaf, you hear it. But you ignore it.
Right.
See, it goes to the mind, but mind says it has nothing to do with me. I don't know whom he is talking about.
Okay.
So the sound will fall on the ears, the vibrations will go to the brain. And the brain will report to the mind. Brain has to do. Mind is more than the brain.
Right.
Mind says, that's none of my business. That can happen only when the mind follows its master, which is the Atman.
Correct.
I am busy, don't disturb me. The mind should say that.
One very beautiful way is devotion and complete surrender to God. Then my senses are diverted and, you know, surrender to God. So that is one way. Then it says purity of one's impulses, sincerity of purpose and determination in treading the divine path that count rather than the environment. He says you cannot blame the environment. He says especially youngsters should not blame the environment.
And Swami gives a wonderful example here. Swami talks about Kabir and Tukaram. One has a very good wife, the other has a very troublesome wife.
Yeah.
But he says both could reach God. Because it doesn't depend on what is around you. It depends on your sense of purpose and your purity. That is the thing Swami says there. Then Swami says when the attention of any sense organ is distracted by something...
What happens when there are two troublesome wives?
No.
Probably becomes a sannyasi.
And the other point Swami makes is when the attention of any sense organ is distracted by something, it should be diverted to another desirable thing. By means of a stronger incentive or disincentive.
See, that is a very important point which most people miss. Sometimes it's very difficult to do certain things. For example, I have met many people who come from countries where they eat a lot of meat. I try very hard, I am not able to give it up. I tell them, listen, do you love Swami? Oh, yes, yes, of course. If you really serve Swami, well, why don't you do it for Swami? You will not be very happy. So, if you have some entity like that which you adore, you can easily sacrifice something because of your love for that person.
Right.
Otherwise, in the abstraction, it becomes difficult. Because there is no way of diverting.
Correct.
I remember Professor K.S. Krishna. He was a very brilliant physicist. He was the founder, director of National Physical Laboratory. And Prime Minister Nehru once said, I would rather be in this position, your position, than in the position I am. He loved science. He was a great scholar of Sanskrit and Tamil spiritual literature and all that. Apart from being very good in physics. He was a good South Indian Brahmin, and he went to Russia many, many years ago, Soviet Union in those days, and he went to what was then called Leningrad. Now it has become St. Petersburg.
Petersburg.
There was an institute for semiconductors and all that, and they had invited him. And they had a big party. And in those parties, you know, the Russians love to get drunk. So they came to him and said, "You must drink this." He said, "Look, I don't drink this." Then he said, "You know, I can't drink because I've given my word to my mother." Then he said, "Don't be a fool. Your mother is so far away. What will she know?" Then he said, "I had to think of a way of doing, getting rid of this fellow's pressure." He said, "All right. You say I have come to your country and I must do what you do. Fair enough. But then, before I do that, you must do what I do in my country. If you do that, I will do it. Do what you say." They said, "Okay, fine." Then he took a glass, filled it with water, and in true South Indian style, he drank it like this.
Oh, lifted the glass.
Yeah, glass and drank it. They said, "You do this."
Without sitting.
And they were all drunk. They all did abhishekam to themselves. So he said, "See, you can do what I do. So I can't do what you do." And he escaped. He used his...
He says that yukti.
Yukti. So, what I'm trying to say is, he says, "I've given my word to my mother, and so I won't do it." Even though I'm here. That's the point I'm trying to make.
See, one devotee was mentioning, sir, a very beautiful point. He said that whenever Swami would give an interview, and in that interview, if there was a person who had just had a puff of cigarette, Swami was very, very allergic to that smell of cigarette. And there were times when Swami would have an upset stomach after that interview and would not eat for 2 or 3 days. And he observed this and he said, "Swami, why are you being like that?" Swami said, "I just cannot stand that smell. Because whenever I get that smell, I have to go back to my room and vomit. That's how bad it is." And then after that, Swami told a very beautiful point. He said, "See, always remember that Swami is in you. So whatever Swami does not like, if you intake it, understand that I'll be puking inside and I'll be struggling inside." And he said that became such a strong imagery for him that he just kept away from even the, might not be something like smoking, but even the lesser things which Swami would not like, because that image of Swami struggling and suffering inside was so strong for him.
Correct. No.
Krishna takes it one step further. He says, "When you beat another man, you don't know you are beating me." I mean you and also in that person. So that is something that people, all the knowledgeable people, don't understand.
Right.
Otherwise, why would they build more and more horrible bombs and waste so much money and build up a tension for no reason at all? How can you call them intelligent?
Correct. Then Swami gives another name. He says senses are called pashu, animals. You should aspire to become Pashupati, the master of senses.
Correct.
Then investigating the source of sense pleasure. He says all sense pleasure is actually born from sorrow. He says sorrow is the source because it is temporary, and the moment you satisfy your senses, the moment is over, it passes.
He calls it hunger. I don't know about sorrow, but he used to call it hunger. See, you crave for it. Hunger in the sense craving. The normal hunger is natural. It is needed, built in, because you have to eat, otherwise you will die. So it is given. But hungering for something, you say. What it means is craving.
Right, correct.
Like craving makes you this thing. Go for it. Actually, very interesting psychological studies have been done. Craving comes from the mind.
Okay.
And once you yield to it, after a while, your brain gets hardwired. Then it's nothing to do with the mind. The chemistry of your body compels you to go for it. For example, a drunkard knows that it is bad for him, but he cannot stop it. So when they go to rehab, basically, they'd sort of unwire the hardwiring via the mind.
Okay.
So they have to literally subject him to mind control and unwire it so that the craving comes down. So the problem starts with the mind, and it has to be taken out with the mind, like using a thorn to remove a thorn, as Swami sometimes says. That's a very interesting finding of modern science. The craving, in a different sense, it reminds me of what Duryodhana says.
Mm-hmm.
He says, I know what adharma is, but I am sorry, I can't avoid it. It's almost like addiction to adharma. I'm talking of addiction to drugs and alcohol. But he was addicted to adharma. He says, I know what adharma is, but I am unable to prevent myself getting involved with it, indulging in it.
Maybe that answers one of the questions I wanted to ask. That is, when we see...
Hey, I seem to be clairvoyant.
No, because one of the questions I was thinking of is, when you actually see, smell, hear good or bad things, what is it that decides that this particular thing is good or bad? Because if the senses, if the eye is seeing something, what is it that tells the eye that this is good or this is bad? Is it the self or is it the mind or how? What is it that prompts? Because the senses are just instruments through which you are seeing something. But there is something else that decides that what you are seeing is good or not good.
That is buddhi.
That is buddhi.
You see, your body temperature is supposed to be normally 98.4 in the old days. I don't know what it's in centigrades. I'm too lazy to calculate. If the thermometer shows less, then there is trouble. If the thermometer shows more, there is trouble. Thermometer doesn't know. It is you who know that that this is not good, that is good.
Correct.
Okay, the same way, the buddhi gives norms to the mind. This is good, that is bad. But what is the meaning of good and what is bad? Good is that which will take you towards God. Bad is that will take you away from God. That is the simple definition of good and bad.
Very beautiful.
Or if you want it even simpler, good is what will make Swami happy. Bad is what Swami will not be happy about. It is as simple as that. So if you want to do something, you can just ask honestly, not fake. If I do this, will Swami be happy? If you honestly answer that question, it is very easy to find out what is good and what is bad. All of us who have seen Swami and experienced him in the sense of being with him and all that, and I would heard him, are in a much more advantageous position with regard to discrimination than those who have not had that benefit. So in fact, one of our duties in Radio Sai is to make all this kind of criteria available to a wider audience.
Correct.
So that they can apply it also.
Right.
Even though they might not have seen Swami. If you put it across in a proper way, they will understand. And once they have the yearning for Swami, they will also do the same things. That's one of our jobs.
In fact, just for the benefit of our listeners, there was one question I asked in one of the earlier sessions where you had given a very beautiful answer as to how do you decide whether the voice that comes from within is the voice of conscience or the voice of mind. Now in Swami's physical absence, we always rely back on the voice of conscience. And the beautiful answer that you actually gave is that there is absolutely only one answer that the conscience gives. There are no two answers.
It's not a bargain sale.
So,
buy one, you get two free. Or
in fact, some people adapt the method of putting chits in front of Swami's photo, whose voice of conscience is very meek or very low. But that's a good method, and I have physically seen Swami endorsing that method.
See, it is all right, provided you have total faith.
That's true.
Right.
But if the thing comes out properly, maybe Swami didn't hear it, so let me do it a second time.
No, best of threes and best of fives is not.
Then you go to the third umpire and...
Like somebody said, if you have a dilemma between two things, you toss a coin. When the coin is tossing, you will know what you want to do. Not when you actually...
It's the heads, I win, tails, you lose kind of thing. That's all nonsense. A simple thing is, why put chits? Why don't you go beyond that? If you are all that devoted to Swami, why don't you train your conscience to answer the question? That means you must clear up the buddhi channel. This is a shortcut and I would say an addiction.
That's true.
Swami has given so many discourses. Right. Why don't you pay attention to that? This is a way of, you know, almost insulting Swami. You know, you don't pay attention to his teachings and you want him to pick a chit for you. What is this? Is that all what God is, lottery? You reduce him to a lottery? Come on, man. Give him a break.
Then he says, if we look deep within, we can see the fleeting nature of sense pleasure and attain detachment. The defects that you attribute to senses are in fact the defects in your own thoughts, process and feelings. So correct them. And he says, we accept mistakes by saying, to err is human. Man has been blessed by God with an intellect, so you have no reason to say the following, the senses is okay. So he says, just by saying to err is human is just a lame excuse.
And then following
absolutely
the senses.
Then following the senses, so he says...
I mean, you know, this thing is ridiculous. Supposing you are drunk, you drive, and you kill a man. To err is human. Can you say that? That's not correct.
In fact, the following that Swami makes a very profound statement here. He says, what you should strive for is freedom from the senses and not freedom of the senses.
Exactly. There are two different things, fundamentally different. And he says, freedom of the senses makes you a slave of the senses.
Right.
Correct.
And then he follows that by saying that...
Actually, you said the mind must master. In this case, the slaves become the master and the mind becomes the slave.
Right.
Correct.
Senses become the master and the mind becomes the slave.
In fact, Swami actually in another place explains the Kathopanishad analogy. Swami is saying if the horse is given the free ride, it pulls the reins. The reins are the mind. So the buddhi should be the one who holds the reins tight. And that's why Swami says in the one on buddhi, he says hold the reins.
Correct.
That's
correct.
The title of that discourse itself.
Then he says, one important aspect, he says, character-centered education, learning to control the senses and lead virtuous life. Students must strive for this balance. And
actually, this is the point where Swami is stressing on educating the intellect, where you are empowering the intellect so that the senses do not take the upper hand. The education which is character-centric, that actually... does that.
In fact, that is one of my complaints. Today's education doesn't bother about that. And even in the so-called EHU and Balukas, we don't talk about these things. We talk about very peripheral things. And okay, maybe the child is very young, you can't talk too much. But you have to start, you know, training even the child, even at a very early age, the art of discrimination. Art of discrimination must be taught. There are various ways of doing it. And the discipline must start at an early age. And then gradually when you build up, then the child will get accustomed to it. I give a very simple example. In our system of music, classical music, you are not allowed to go apashruti even when you are young. They don't say, all right, later on you can. In fact, it is very dangerous.
Right.
So, shruti and talam, the teacher will insist. And they will do, there are a lot of drills. And varnam and all that is part of the drill.
Correct.
And you have to go through that. You have to go through that. We don't do all those things. We say there is no time, this, that. A lot of phony excuses are given these days. In fact, one of the tragedies is life is given to us by God and life is time. Time is the stuff life is made of, as has been said somewhere. If you don't have 5 minutes of this time or if your life for God, saying you're busy, that is ingratitude. Today, people are all busy. They are saying, I am very busy, I am very busy, I am very busy. So it has come to a stage where science fiction is going to become true. People will leave Prashanti before they arrive. They are so busy.
It's like that story which they say, a man who prays 10 minutes every day is accosted by his agnostic friend and he's saying, you're wasting 15 minutes of your day. Mm. You know, every day you're wasting. And he said, okay, see, if let's say God is not there, I wasted only 15 minutes. And if God is there, you wasted your life. You know, I made such a valuable investment and you missed out on that.
Talking of a little bit of science, you know, there is this concept of the observer influencing the observed. Like if you take the example of light, is it a particle or a wave? So that means what we are perceiving and are trying to understand with our senses, is it that that knowledge is incomplete or that it is influenced by us? How do we understand that?
See, you have made a huge jump.
Mm-hmm.
First, let us come to observation. There are two kinds of observation, what is called active and passive.
Mm-hmm.
Supposing there is a submarine.
Okay.
One submarine belongs to country A, another submarine belongs to country B. B thinks A is an enemy, A thinks B is an enemy.
Mm.
So B wants to find out whether A is around.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the submarine, if it is moving, its engine is working. So that engine will generate sound, and that sound will propagate through the water.
Mm-hmm.
If B wants to do a passive observation, there are two things he must do. First is, he must make a submarine very quiet.
Mm-hmm.
Today they are very quiet submarines.
Mm.
And I won't go into those details. Second thing is, he must have very sensitive detectors.
Mm-hmm.
Because he is quiet, A will not know B is there. Secondly, he has got very sensitive detectors and he will hear, detect A by the sound A produces.
Mm.
So this is passive.
Mm.
The old days there was no passive thing. They will send a sonar pulse, and if there's a submarine, it will reflect back as an echo. Mm.
Okay.
So from that echo he'll detect. That fellow, he will know that somebody is bouncing, so immediately he can send a torpedo and attack you. So that is passive and active.
Mm.
Now, coming back to your question, what is the last part of your question?
Like when we are observing things,
yes,
through our senses,
yes,
is it that what we observe through the senses gives us an incomplete understanding of what it is?
It depends on what you mean by understanding.
Mm-hmm.
At an empirical level, the senses may give an understanding.
Mm-hmm.
You are walking and you see a snake.
Mm-hmm.
That is an empirical reality and you'd better avoid the snake. As Ramakrishna Paramahansa says, tiger is also Narayana, but that doesn't mean you go and pat the tiger like you will pat your cat. You will be in great trouble. So there is an empirical reality and a practical response is required. But is the tiger just a tiger?
Mm-hmm.
If you are able to realize tiger is part of creation, and tiger has an aspect of the creator and has been put there for some purpose which creator knows, then you will not disturb the tiger. It is none of your business to disturb the tiger or do anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And unless you have that attitude, you will you run the risk of damaging the ecosystem of which you are a part.
Correct.
If you go on recklessly killing tiger as is happening now because it is considered, you know, very healthy to eat this part of tiger and that will cure this disease of yours and all that. There's a lot of Chinese medicine based on tiger which is fake, complete fake.
Mm-hmm.
Then you're destroying the ecosystem without realizing you're a part of it. You are not something separate from this system. You are connected to it. Because today you are killing the tiger, tomorrow you will cut trees, day after tomorrow, we are already polluting the air, water and land.
Hmm.
You have come from them. You are breathing the air in order to survive. You are drinking the water in order to survive. You, if the land is not there, you will, if it's water, you will drown. And the land gives you food. And you cut yourself off from all these things and fill the land with mercury, cadmium and junk, old electronic equipment, asbestos from various places and things like that. So, what is causing this?
Mm-hmm.
Is it understanding? You have not understood.
Correct.
You have understood only in a limited respect. This land, it's property, I can make money, I can bury the waste here. You look at it that way, no? That's not understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding means understanding in a total context. Mm-hmm. Limited understanding is ignorance. It's not understanding, it's dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, somebody who is addicted to a substance or something, somebody who is a smoker, addict to smoking, to satisfy one senses, he's ready to spoil the whole body. I think that is what is happening in the largest section in the society. Like, man is forgetting that to satisfy himself, which is just a small part in this whole large entity, he's ready to, land the whole
basically
body.
Basically, this
trouble.
Is his own selfishness. He wants to make money, so he makes you spend money, and that comes to him. And that money comes to him because he gives you something and he makes you want it. Owner's pride, neighbor's envy, owner's pride kind of thing.
Well,
do they still have that ad?
Yeah.
It used to be in the old days.
I don't think so.
So maybe today's listener may not understand what we are talking about.
Right.
For the record, it's an advertisement for a television. And when you buy it, your neighbor gets jealous. And that makes you happy, not owning the TV. Seeing his jealousy, turning green with envy.
Right.
See, I am better than you. I got
Vipralipsa,
something
that is Vipralipsa, that is jealousy. And Swami has mentioned that actually in the next...
Well, it has been there from very early times.
The good part of the next discourse, which is still on the senses, is about controlling the tongue. And Swami gives a lot of emphasis on controlling the tongue. And he says the four major lapses are lies, rumoring, backbiting, criticizing and excessive talk.
And today, we have made it into one fivefold mix.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Rumor, excessive talk, mischief, everything is made into one multi-flavored ice cream.
The wonderful analogy which Swami gives here also is, if you want to control the horse, you have to bridle it in the mouth.
Correct.
So Swami says, we want to control your senses, start with the tongue. That's the most critical thing. In fact, Swami goes on to say that, you know, if the tongue is conquered, it virtually amounts to mastering all the senses and merging in the divine self. That's how much importance
Swami don't know is whether you are noticing one thing. Two things. First is, in the Gita, Krishna talks about these things very briefly. You must control the senses and all that. Second thing is, people who give lectures on the Gita, they will give lectures on the Gita.
Mm-hmm.
But Krishna talks to us in the same wavelength as, Swami talks to us in the same wavelength as Krishna, but in a more expanded form. He doesn't bother to explain the Gita. He is expanding the Gita.
Correct.
And that only God can do. The fellows who talk about Gita can only talk about Gita. They can make it interesting, funny and all that. Whereas, Swami is striving very hard to give that lesson in 25 different ways so that at least one of them sticks in one corner of your mind.
Correct.
It shows enormous concern. And who will be so concerned? One who loves you dearly. Who is going to love you dearly? Only God. Why? Because you are a part of Him. That is one aspect we don't pay much attention to when we listen to Swami's discourse.
True.
We only talk about Swami said this, Swami said that. We don't talk about why He said that. What he said. Am I following that? How much trouble he has taken to tell us that? I mean, you look at all the books written about the Gita. You won't find a single book that goes into all these details. I challenge you. Hmm. You show me one book, I'm ready to eat it. Like that. And only Swami has done that. And that is because he is the one who gave the Gita.
Correct.
Do we ever realize that? As I sit listening to you recall this, I'm just astonished. It's just amazing.
I mean, yeah.
And how much trouble he has taken.
Resonating with what you said, sir, though we have gone through these discourses in a span of at least 14, 15 weeks, it is still, you know, so much awe is inspired when we go through this, because to the detail with which Swami has gone, especially in the discourses about the mind and the
origin of that detail.
Right.
Is the love.
He is so concerned about you. Mm. Who will talk to you like that? Will tell you in different ways so that at least one of them sticks.
In fact, very befitting to this strain of thought, this discourse ends with the idea of gratitude. And he says, you buy a piece of land for which you pay money. You build a house for which you have to pay the money. You do everything for which you have to pay, and you have to pay tax as well. But have you given any tax to God? Do you have gratitude to God?
Nothing.
Do you show gratitude to God?
No, we don't.
I mean, the amount of... I won't say...
By the way, the land is given free.
Correct.
All the materials which you use for building come from raw materials created by God.
Mm.
If brick is there, where did the brick come from? If sand has been used for mixing with cement, where did the sand come? Everything, water, everything has been by God. Poor God gives everything free. And you say there is no God. I don't believe in God. Wow. What a shame.
Taking the whole thing one step subtler, where he talks about the mind, he, you know, the famous shloka where he says, Maneva manushyanam karanam mandha mokshayo. The mind is responsible for bondage and liberation. The mind itself is so vast, and he classifies it into four aspects. One is manas, buddhi, chitta, ahankara. Manas is the mind. The buddhi is the
discriminating.
Discriminating mind. Then chitta is where the memory is stored.
Impressions.
And, impressions. And ahankara is when you identify yourself with the body.
Right.
So, often described as ego.
Ego.
He
yes.
calls it dehabhimanam.
Correct. Right. So he says a mind is basically a bundle of thoughts. And these thoughts gives
See,
rise to...
the ahamkara points to wrong identification.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, you are aham.
Correct.
Instead of identifying yourself with aham, you are identifying with the body, dehabhimanam.
Right.
Correct.
And that is wrong identification. Mistaken identity. And then you ruin your whole life believing you are that, not this.
Correct.
Swami says that you attach the aham to the akara.
Ahankara.
That becomes ahankara. And then Swami, in the beginning of
exactly,
the discourse...
Exactly, form. That is why they have
right.
been mano. And you start loving it.
Right. And do go any extent to foster it. Here actually Swami starts that discourse in the mind by saying, why should we look keenly at the mind? Why should we understand the mind? There Swami says this thing where he says, basically any entity is a combination of the mind, the body and the Atma.
Mm-hmm.
And when these three are coordinated, when you understand that it is mind, body, Atma and you are, these are coordinated in line with the other, then it's a man. And when there is...
No, not enough. Mm-hmm. There is a hierarchy. Atma first, mind next,
right.
body last. So it must be AMV.
Exactly. Not giving
any
one
other combination is
right.
Dangerous.
Right.
Then there are two aspects which Swami brings out in the two discourses that he is dealing with the mind. He says the mind is subject to three kind of pollutions. Mala, Vrikshepa and Avarna. Mala is like having dust on a mirror. So that is due to actions accumulated over many births, impressions stored in the chitta. That is mala. And he says this dust or dirt can be removed by proper ahara and vihara, because the subtle aspect of the food goes and influences the mind. Vikshepa, on the other hand, is constant wavering.
Before that, Mala Swami says a universal solution is Brahmarpanam.
That's
offering
true.
Everything to
offering
God.
Offering everything to God.
Because Swami says that Patra Shuddhi, Padartha Shuddhi, you cannot ensure all that, so Brahmarpanam is the best way.
Vikshepa is constant wavering, and he says to still this defect of the mind, the Navaveda Bhakti Marga is the best. And then Avarna is like putting a cloth on the mirror. And he says this can be removed. This is caused by the Kama Krodha Lobha Moha.
By the way, talking of cloth of the mirror, the mirror, a funny thing happened many years ago in one of the district offices in Uttar Pradesh. And it's a government office. And they were auctioning liquor licenses. So everybody had come, the auction was about to take place. Somebody said, hey, Mahatma Gandhi's photo is there. So they took a bit sheet and put it over it. And then they conducted the auction. So, what does that last word?
Avarna.
Avarna. So, he's watching. All his life he said he was against liquor. So he said, let him not say Avarna.
In fact, they believe that he is watching. That itself is great.
I remember another incident when one of our students, at home, he was watching TV. And just beside the TV, there was a calendar of Swami. So he got a little guilty, and what he did, he took the calendar, rolled it up, and he continued seeing TV. And when he came back, and Swami was giving darshan, Swami walked up to him, and very, very softly, even the next person wouldn't have heard, Swami told, Swami, calendar mein nahi hai ra, and walked away.
How do you know if it's very soft?
No, this boy himself shared.
Okay.
Because he was so moved by that act of Swami, that love with which Swami came and told him, and the concern that, you know, he shouldn't be embarrassed.
But at least he thought he was watching. that's something that's
to start with.
Swami says the only way to remove this avarna is to love all and serve all. So I think it comes back to that.
Right. And then of course Swami gives another four or five different other pollutions which the mind suffers from. But eventually the way Swami ends that discourse is very beautiful. Swami says, okay, I've told all this now. I've told you all the problems the mind has, the senses have. But to give it to you all in the easiest way, what you're supposed to do is think no evil, think what is good. See no evil, see what is good. Hear no evil, hear what is good. Talk no evil, talk what is good. Do no evil, do what is good. He says, remember these five sentences, all will be taken care of. And that's how Swami ends this discourse on the mind, the two discourses on the mind.
So I think in a very hurried way, we have summarized what Swami has spoken on the mind. But eventually when we complete the entire set of discourses, we should go back, revisit and revise the syllabus. Because most of it is like a very well-structured syllabus laid out in front of us. And
then what are you trying to revise? I don't understand.
No, go back to these points again and then recollect them. That would contribute to Shravanam part of it. Mananam and Nididhyasanam. Nididhyasanam we have to follow.
Nididhyasanam is applying to real life.
That's true.
You see, for example, that fellow watching TV, he knew he was not supposed to waste his time. Still he find a way of, it's like dodging income tax. that's not correct. So really speaking, that is what understanding is all about. You asked about understanding. Then he is not understood. He is trying to bypass it.
So, thank you, sir. Thank you for this wonderful session. And that, dear listeners, brings us to the end of this summary which we endeavored, the first eight discourses. So, next week, hopefully, we'll start with the ninth discourse in the series and continue the same format we've been following all these weeks. So, on behalf of all of you, I thank Professor Venkatraman for being with us. And on behalf of Sai Prakash and Venkatraman sir, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai. We offer this effort of ours at Bhagwan's Lotus Feet. And as always, thank him for this opportunity. The next program is the Outside, Inside, Deep Inside segment with Bishu. Bishu is here with his guest. So please stay tuned and enjoy the last segment of the day. Thank you. Jai Sai Ram.